Okay. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the podcast or live video podcast or webinar today. And I have a very special guest with me, and I'm super excited to have him finally on the podcast. So Dr. Charles Runnels, I'm going to do a quick introduction because he was my introduction to sexual wellness, which is a huge passion of mine. And I learned everything that I know from him. So I can't say enough about him, and I am excited to have him. We're going to talk about all the things, sexual wellness, but a lot about women's health and sexual wellness, which is advancing. So welcome, Dr. Runnels, if you want to say a few words and tell us about yourself.
Well, thank you for the kind words. Definitely, we teach each other. I'm not going to claim at all that I taught you everything you know, but we've swapped notes for a number of years now. How long? Almost a decade, it feels like.
Yeah, no, it's been a long time. Yeah, I came to Fairhope to train with you way back.
Yes. Part of the fun of it is I think sometimes it's hard, you know, it's hard for the fish inside the aquarium to see the water, and it's hard for people in the middle of a revolution to realize that they are sometimes, but we are. There's two revolutions going on right now. One is with just socially women's sexual health. And the revolution is back in the 60s, it became okay for women to have sex. You've got the birth control pill, and now it's women are having sex. But the thing that happened about the time of 50 Shades of Grey is it became socially acceptable for women to demand good sex. And everything that implies, including demanding that their physicians think as deeply and as carefully about their sexuality and how to improve it and treat it as what happens with men. And the other revolution that's going on is just within the science of medicine, where now we have regenerative therapies that you and I did not have as an option back in medical school. So I'm honored to be on the call helping spread the word about why both of these revolutions are important and how your courage, most people may not realize it, but the majority of physicians are still uncomfortable talking about sex, but you're not. And what's different about that, just if you meditate on that for a second, if you're treating sore throats, you can treat sore throats no matter, or you can do a hysterectomy no matter what's going on with you personally. But if you put yourself out as a sexual medicine healer, it means that you have to be comfortable having conversations with your people about whatever topic is relevant to their life. And for you to be able to do that, it means you have to be comfortable with your own sexuality.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Not every doctor is. And so you're a rare bird to have the intelligence and the motivation and the comfort and the scientific training. You're, as you know, a minority among your peers to be able to do all those things. So I'm grateful to be on the call for us to swap notes again.
Yes, me too. Well, and I think that what happens when you created these procedures and your trainings and the Cellular Medicine Association is you attract providers and physicians like myself that are comfortable having those conversations. And we also see how it's lacking in traditional medicine. And so we end up as a group of providers that think alike, right? Mm-hmm. And what people behind the scenes may not know is that Dr. Runnels organizes webinars and meetings every week with the providers. So gets on, presents new research, you know, people discuss what they're doing. There's a meeting of the minds and brainstorming, and it's a great support group. And so again, I highly encourage any providers or physicians that ever listen that don't know much about it to, you know, look into these procedures and this organization, because it's awesome. The support that you get is amazing and unrivaled.
Thank you. And I think it's mostly because, not me, it's mostly because we do have right at 2,500 providers as of now, 50-something countries, and we are sharing notes and sharing ideas and sharing research real time. If you think about what happened, it's hard to believe now, but when Bill Clinton was elected president, there were only 35,000 websites total on the planet. And if you published some the conversation between physicians at that time, who didn't really even have websites much, was if you have an idea, you publish it in the New England Journal or whatever. If you have an idea about that, you write a letter to the editor. Both of those things take a month or two to be approved. And so it's like playing chess by snail mail, which I did back in the 70s in high school. And now you have, in the same way you can play chess real time online with someone, physicians can exchange ideas and research and what their patients are telling them. And the information travels so quickly. So I consider myself very blessed to mostly just be a facilitator of bright minds like yourself and the research that's coming out. I didn't set out to be the sex doctor guy. I'll tell you what really happened. And just to go to flash back 24 years now, 25 years, I really think Suzanne Somers did us all a big one, rest her soul. But what happened before she did her first book was back in 1999, I was about to stop the my work as an emergency room physician and open up a practice. My boards were internal medicine. So I was going to courses while still working as an ER doctor, which I did, as I said, for 12 years. But I'm going to courses about how to take care of women because women rule medicine. I don't care if you're the head of a department at Harvard. If you're a man, there's a woman somewhere who decides where you go to the doctor. So I decided if I wanted a busy practice, I should be the best doctor possible of taking care of 40-year-old women because they rule medicine. So I'm attending a lecture at Las Vegas in 1999, 25 years ago. And a guy, it's one of those life-changing lectures. A gynecologist stood up and presented research about how he was treating women who had menstrual-associated migraines with testosterone pellets. And 25 years ago, to get the good pellets, you had to order them from Europe. Compounding pharmacies in the States weren't making them that much. Mm-hmm. But his research was so compelling, when I opened my medical practice in 2000, 24 years ago, I started offering, after doing blood testing, that as part of my offerings for how to take care of women. And within a very short time, just a matter of a couple of years, I had a practice. I was taking care of 3,000 women. I was doing their hormones, flying in from all over the world. Most people were still prescribing estrotest, which, you know, bodybuilders won't even take oral testosterone. It's bad for your liver. Mm-hmm. But there was a Premarin, as you know, there was pill that had Premarin combined with testosterone. It was trash. But that was the best you had if you wanted to prescribe testosterone to women, because we still don't even have an FDA-approved injection. So I started doing it, and people flew in from everywhere, didn't know what the heck I was doing. They just knew their mama, sister, and best friend all lost 40 pounds and were having circus sex, and they wanted to get some of the same thing. And it took a long time. And then Suzanne Somers did that first book. And when she did that book, people knew. And I was so grateful because she, in my opinion, changed medicine dramatically, because then women started demanding that their doctor think more carefully about women's hormones. And so if you do hormone replacement for 3,000 women, you have to think about sex. You'd be stupid to learn something. So that's what led up to these procedures and regenerative medicine being integrated into it, was just so many women wanting treatment and in the quest for how to take care of them. But it really started with that one lecture back in 1999.
Yeah, there are pivotal points, right? And in our careers and life. Yes. And so that was one of them. And I'll tell you, like every single day, and that drives, you know, the passion is that every single day, you end up hearing from women that are talking about, you know, the problems they're having and no one listening to them at all. Yes.
I want to make one comment about that listening comment, because it's so important, I think, for your followers to know. And you just said it, but let me expand upon what you know. If you have a broken arm, you might post it on Facebook and get people to sign your cast. If you have breast cancer, you may ask for people to pray for you and let your family and friends know. But if you have two types of problems, you're likely to hide it in shame. One of them is psychiatric problems. If you're, and it's tragic, but if you're diagnosed with schizophrenia or even major depression, you're likely to keep that a secret because you're more likely to receive criticism or to be shunned, if not criticized, if you let people know you have a psychiatric diagnosis. And unfortunately, it's exactly the same with sexual medicine. For proof, just go to any blog where some woman has posted for anyone to react that she has sexual problems. And you'll see, largely from women, you'll see very unsympathetic responses. And so what she's learned very quickly is it's not safe to tell her husband or lover because for fear that she'll hurt their feelings. It's not safe to tell most of her friends. It's not safe to tell her priest or a rabbi or a preacher. And so she often just doesn't tell anyone. And research shows if she even brings it up to the doctor because of the reasons we already said, the doctor, unless that doctor is comfortable with their sexuality or has learned options for treatment like we know, research has proven this, the doctor will change the subject the vast majority of the time after answering the first question. So she's left largely
without solutions.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, sorry to rant, but we both see all this. And I think it's super important to let your listeners know that their experience is not unusual. Mm-hmm. But we have answers now, and there are doctors like yourself who have the expertise and the courage to have the conversation.
Yes. And I think that, again, getting back to even your book, and I say that because I've been reading a lot more of like sexual, not sexual wellness, but books on sex across the board just to see what's in them. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not very good information, honestly. And a lot of it is misleading. There was a recent one like Great Sex Starts at 50, which, you know, the first part of the book isn't about that at all, but it still can be great at 50 and beyond. And your OSHOP book kind of gets at that for women, which is why, and I had that sitting beside me, made me think of it. But in the 10 years that we've known each other, in the 10 years I've been practicing, again, the sexual wellness part of it has really taken off. And it's my passion, but the approaches from traditional medicine haven't changed at all in that 10-year period.
Yes.
We're not talking about it anymore.
I think there's another hidden speed bump to our colleagues who, as you know, the vast majority of our colleagues are good people. They went to medicine because they want to help people. But there's another speed bump that happens. It's largely from a very understandable fear, and that is that if you look at the available options, they're often not FDA approved, which sounds scary, but most people don't realize that 21, depending on which study you read, 21 to 31% of all the prescriptions written, all of them, including your family doctor, are written off-label. And the speed bump, the hit, meaning that there's research to support the idea, but the FDA has not approved it. So this is a huge distinction that I think everyone, including maybe most doctors, have not really thought about deeply. They're just, for example, we know that swapping from a serotonin uptake inhibitor like Prozac to Wellbutrin for depression shows a dramatic improvement for women who have trouble with sex because of that Prozac or whatever their SSRI antidepressant is. That's well proven, well shown, multiple studies. But Wellbutrin is not FDA approved for improving sex. So here's the hidden part of that that I think even really pertains to almost everything we're talking about. And it's why it pertains to the reason probably most of the books are not up to date and are preaching something that was exactly the right thing to do 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's this, there are certain populations, and this has been written about in the research, there are certain populations that are considered orphan populations with orphan indications, meaning that the research is strong, but no company is going to spend the money to prove to the FDA that it works because it's a difficult study population to look at. For example, mm-hmm. children or pregnant women or even women of pregnant bearing age, or if the thing to prove is hard. In other words, the legal liability is so huge and the difficulty in proving it is so difficult that the pharmaceutical company knows they're going to waste literally $1 billion, probably still not get it approved. And then the other flip side of it is they think, why should we spend the money? Because doctors are already writing the prescription, for example, for Wellbutrin to help with sex. So they're disincentivized by two things. One, doctors already prescribing it. Two, it's in an orphan category. And one of those categories is proving that a drug helps women with sex. For as you know, you can't just prove an objective thing. Like if I want to get a drug approved for men, and there's over 20 of them approved for men, and the only two approved for women are psych drugs, but there's 20 of them approved plus for men, most of them help the man's penis. But the reason you can do that more easily is that you just measure it by how hard does it get? Does it get hard or not? That's an objective thing. Where to prove that it works for a woman, you have to prove a very nebulous thing. Is she more satisfied or not? And that can become so nebulous that it's just you just hardly can't do it. Yeah. You're left with only two drugs for women, and you're left with all these books coming out and the preaching something that only includes what the FDA has approved. And then the last point, and then I'll quit ranting, is that the FDA does two things. It regulates drugs and devices to make sure the safety data is accurate. There's risk for everything. And the other is that it, so drugs and devices, but it regulates what the companies can market. So a company's, for example, Wellbutrin cannot market it for sexual dysfunction because they haven't spent the money to prove that it works to the FDA, even though there's a stack of research. But the FDA does not govern the practice of medicine, or else literally 1 in 5 prescriptions are being written right now, maybe 1 in 4, depending on which research you read, almost 1 in 3 in some studies, doctors didn't practice medicine. So people think the FDA doesn't approve surgeries. It's never approved a hysterectomy or a cholecystectomy or an appendectomy. They don't approve which prescriptions we write. But what happens is there's so many of our colleagues, rightly so, are fearful of legal pursuits, either from their medical board or an attorney. They won't write the prescription until the FDA approves it. And because the FDA is never going to approve certain things because of those problems, like there will probably never be an FDA approved form of testosterone for women. So now for the past literally 20 years, we've been writing prescriptions based on stacks of research in the right situation. It is safe and effective to help women with sex in the right situation, but you have people writing books that just blanket say, no, it shouldn't be done, because they're locked into whatever the freaking FDA. It's the ultimate demonstration of the tail wagging the dog. When you have FDA bureaucrats, when you have doctors letting FDA bureaucrats tell them whether or not they should pay attention to the research. Sorry to rant, but I think that relates to everything we're talking about.
I actually love it, you know, because again, I can do that same thing, but you hear from patients every day. And the other thing is that regenerative procedures are not going to be studied like a drug company would study something else, but patients are more proactive than providers in this area. You know, they come in looking for solutions that aren't necessarily FDA approved. They're not very trusting of that, but they want to look and they see that other people, you know, the effectiveness is there, the safety is there, and they're actually very proactive about looking for something that doesn't involve necessarily a drug or a surgery. So that's what I hear on a daily basis. And
you bring up another point that PRP is not even a drug. So it's like having the FDA look at your urine or your spit. your blood belongs to you. The FDA doesn't get to regulate that.
Yes, correct. And so they miss, you know, I think there's lots of misperceptions out there, you know, even like compounded pharmacies when we're doing hormones, that those are an issue because it's not an FDA approved form. You know, it's identical to some FDA approved forms. It's just more customized, but those pharmacies are regulated. So yeah, mm-hmm. there's a lot of misperceptions, but women have been left behind for a while, you know, yeah. and just not addressing concerns, you know, again, they get one or two questions in, like you said, and there's no solutions. And it's not that the doctor means, you know, any to leave them out or to not inform them, but they don't know about the solution. So how can they mm-hmm. tell them?
Yes.
So I think that's where I've seen a lot of advancements in the last, you know, 2 years significantly with women's health. Mm-hmm. So we're at least starting to talk about it more. But you know, when it comes to sexual dysfunction in women, who knows it better than you? So like even kind of just talking about how wide that range is, you know, can mean lots of different things. And, you know, from sex drive all the way to pain with sex. But if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I'd love to get in to the OSHOT, you know, and then your latest stuff that you are, you know, researching and bringing to women's health, which is the Clitoxin.
Yes. Well, thank you for bringing those ideas up. And it relates exactly to what you just talked about, regenerative therapies, because not only does the FDA not regulate your blood and your saliva and your urine and your skin. Like if you do another good analogy is if you have a burn and the doctor takes a piece of skin from your back and covers your wound with it to try to help it, that skin belongs to you. It's got nothing to do with the FDA. In the same way, if you take some plasma and you get the platelets out of your body and put it back into your body in a thoughtful and strategic way, such that it triggers your body to heal more effectively, those platelets belong to you, and they're not regulated. Now, the device that prepares it is and should be regulated by the FDA, but the platelets are yours. Now, here's a question I think for your readers to contemplate that I like. You know, everybody loves a war. The problem is that we want a war that's holy, that's worth fighting, and we want a war that helps people. It doesn't hurt people. So, So I like fighting wars against diseases, right? I have my worst diseases that I hate the most. I don't have any people that I hate, but I have, or any groups of people that I hate, but I hate acne, and I hate because I had it as a teenager. I hate sexual dysfunction because it rips families apart. And, you know, but I don't have enough energy to hate all diseases. I like to know about them all, but I have a few that I just hate. And so if you're on this call and you're a fan of Dr. Durst, you probably are okay with declaring war on sexual dysfunction. So let's just do that right now. And now that we've declared war on sexual dysfunction, let's just think about something that I hope makes you angry, because if you're going to be a good warrior, you need to get a little bit angry about something. So here's something to get angry about. I will promise you that if you are an NFL football player, I don't even care if you're a Tom Brady in the spotlight kind of guy, dating Taylor Swift and all that. I'm just saying you're a no-name running back, but you play in the NFL and you tear your thigh muscle. I will promise you that you will get platelet-rich plasma injected into that muscle because sports medicine literature is very strong about it, that it activates what amounts to stem cells that belong to you in that muscle that will cause that muscle to heal faster with less scar tissue and recover faster and be able to play again. And if you're making $5 million a year or more and you miss a day of work, we're going to do that. And you don't have an option. You're going to get that. Now, here's the question that should make you angry. Why does that NFL football player's thigh get more and better attention, more based on the current scientific literature when it comes to repairing muscle, than mama's pelvic floor after she delivers a baby? Mm-hmm. Right? Why? Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't she get that as a muscle too? Yes, it is in a sacred place. It's the birthplace of mankind and womankind. And you can argue that it's more sacred than the thigh muscle of a running back. But then you should be more apt to get the treatment. Yeah,
you should be taking care of it more.
Yeah. So you have athletes. Tiger Woods got it in his shoulder. You're going to be hard to find an NFL player that's been around for any length of time that didn't have platelet-rich plasma injected in a muscle or a joint somewhere. Right. But yet it's still some esoteric thing. And it happens because you can have one branch of medicine that mm-hmm. moves faster than the other. Like, as you know, gynecologists were doing endoscopic surgery for years before general surgeons adopted it. Well, the sports medicine people and the orthopedic surgeons have been using platelet-rich plasma for a decade before I ever thought to inject it into the vagina, the clitoris, or the floor of the pelvis of a woman. So sorry to rant, but I want your warrior listeners to have a reason to get up and be angry tomorrow.
Yeah, I love it. And I absolutely agree. And that was you coming up with it, though, too. So you were the first to say, you know, that concept with ortho makes sense, right? Yes. So where else can I inject it? If you want to tell that story, because I think that is, again, it's the pioneering, like, innovators, you know, that are going to push. And as long as it's safe and you can, you know, definitely talk to the safety of PRP, because there's no, you know, studies that show it to be unsafe, because again, it's your own blood and growth factors. Mm-hmm. So if you want to talk a little bit about how you came to that, because again, you were the innovator there.
Well, I don't know that I was any smarter than anybody, but I did happen to be in the right place. And there's a confession involved in this. I told you my background. I had the experience of talking to 3,000 women patients about their hormones and the honor of that. So I was attuned to their lack of the same degree of therapies that men have, and mm-hmm. attuned to their emotional distress. Mm-hmm. As you know, to even be counted as a female sexual dysfunction, the woman by definition has to be psychologically distressed by it. If she has pain with intercourse, but she's living alone, or she has a female lover and there's no penis involved, and she only has pain with penile penetration, that does not count as sexual dysfunction. So by definition, somewhere around 30 to 40% of women by most studies are literally psychologically distressed by something that's broken about their sexuality. And I knew that from talking to 3,000 women. And I was doing cosmetic work because as the women would lose weight, they would tell me that they looked older, as you're seeing now with some of the new drugs. So I learned how to do fillers and neuromodulators like Botox and Dysport, et cetera, so that I could help them regain the structure of their face and they'd want to keep losing weight. So that was the setup. And also was running a wound care center during my ER days at one of the local hospitals. So that was the setup. And then someone walked in, and that was the lucky lining up of the stars. So then someone walked into my office one day and said, we have this stuff called platelet-rich plasma, and you can use it like your fillers, like Juvederm, and there's never been a side effect, but you get new blood flow and you get new volume. And so here's the confession. My first thought, I admit, was that being a man, I had a better place for new volume and new blood flow than the face, because he was recommending I put it in the face. Uh-huh. So I thought, well, I'm going to try this in faces for a while. And I came up with a way to combine it with fillers. And that's how the vampire facelift came along. But my first thought was, I'm going to put this in my penis for volume and blood flow. But in the process of figuring out how to do it in the face and then the penis, I still hadn't advertised it. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, men have all this other stuff. Let me try it. And so my sweetheart at the time, we tried it and she was off the wall having fun. And then I tried it in some of my patients who had problems. And it was really remarkable. My first patient had been abused by her ex-husband, had severe pain, hadn't been able to tolerate penetrative sex for years. And after about 4 weeks to 6 weeks after the treatment, she was having wonderful sex and wound up becoming engaged to and eventually married to a high school lover from years before that. And so my patients taught me about it. And as you know, our group grew and the members of our group, like yourself, taught me about it, how to make it better and how to tune it up and make it better. But I just happened to be at the right time and have all those things in my brain at the same time. And then eventually I rolled out the priapus shot, but it got pushed aside literally for years because I thought women need something better and they need it more urgently than do men. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it all started.
I love it. No, it's definitely innovation. And it's amazing because even getting back to the vampire facelift, I can't tell you how many women come in and, you know, months later, they're just, you know, raving about it. Yeah, you know, because it looks better with time. You know, they leave with some volume and rejuvenation, but they come back in and their skin's glowing and they love it. So, yeah. And the O shot, again, it's interesting because with women, you know, a couple years ago when they would come into the office, it seemed like I had to talk them into, they would come in with the complaints and some of them come in for hormones and then we're talking sexual wellness, they cross over or they come for something related to sex and then we talk hormones. But you almost had to convince them of worth a couple years ago where men would come in convinced they were doing, you know, erectile treatments because mm-hmm. they come in ready to proceed. And you would almost have to convince the women of the worth of her worth in doing it. But I've seen tremendous changes and advances in the last 2 years. They come in ready.
Yes.
So, you know, they see that other women are talking about it. They don't like the effects of medicine and, mm-hmm. you know, and they don't want to have surgery for incontinence and it mm-hmm. does all of the above. Yes. You know, so they get all the functional improvement with it. So it's been amazing, you know, and just I've seen just a huge difference in women now knowing that there's some options, still not getting them, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're traditional doctors, but they know about them and they want them and mm-hmm. tremendous results. So, you know, again, if you wanted to talk about all the different things that even that treats, but yeah. I think across the board, incontinence being a huge, you know, postmenopause and menopause or perimenopause and menopause, they're, you know, about 7% of women get treatment for urinary incontinence.
Yes, there's a couple of things that you said were super important. One of them to point out this, I think it's learned helplessness. And I'll give you an example. There's a man in my town that called me a few weeks ago. And you don't have to wait. As you know, once word's out, you get these kind of calls a lot and can come from either side. This was from the man's side saying that he loved his wife of 30 something years. It broke his heart to think of leaving her, but he's still a fairly young man in his late 50s, early 60s. And she just never wants to have sex. And you know, we were at the meeting in South Florida where we talked about this recently, but the sexual response is confusing because it's the actual response, arousal, desire, and orgasm are autonomic responses. And a woman can be dearly affectionate or in love or whatever positive emotions you might put on that list, but yet still not be aroused and orgasmic and wanting to have sex with her husband. And for her to make herself have those feelings is literally like somehow convincing yourself that you are going to now have a bowel movement or you're mm-hmm. going to now sweat or you're going to now, I mean, think of something. You're going to make your heart beat faster. I guess there's some yogis that can do that, but or change your body temperature. All that's controlled by the hypothalamus. And so for a woman to somehow somatically, voluntarily change those things, it's impossible. And so yes. what we do, and then the result of it is that she then has, it's not just about having fun. then there becomes a strain in relationships, and she may be perfectly self-contained. It doesn't matter. But most of us want some sort of love relationship, and so she can start to feel broken. Mm-hmm. And here's the confusing part, and back to the OSHOT. One of the confusing parts is that if, let's say that someone comes to your office, or back in the ER days, they come and they're short of breath. Well, that's, there's a systems analysis, and everybody saw that poster on their wall in the fifth or sixth grade of everything it takes to breathe. And so a shortness of, and involves your trachea and your blood flow and lungs and all this. So if someone came to the ER and they were short of breath, I wouldn't just try a bronchodilator on everybody that walked in the door. You would talk with them and decide, do they have a foreign body in their trachea? Are they profoundly anemic? Do they have cyanide poisoning? Do they have bronchospasm? Do they have emphysema? Do they have fluid in their lungs from congestive heart failure? And all those things, you think about it, and then you pick the right treatment. And it may be some more than one treatment, but it's thought about in a very methodical systems analysis way. Where with sexual medicine, I don't see this in any other branch of medicine. Mm-hmm. With sexual medicine, because there is a strong psychological component, there tends to be the feeling among many of our colleagues that you can fix everything with that. Mm-hmm. Or someone has a new idea they're going to use, whether it's anything that we do that could be legitimate on its own, a testosterone injection or changing, or maybe it's Kegels, or maybe it's our OSHOT, but somehow you're just going to try, you got a new laser, a new radio frequency device, whatever, you're just going to treat everybody with that. You would never, just like you would never treat everybody with a bronchodilator in the ER, shortness of breath, all of our tools have to be used intelligently. And I'll get an email sometimes from somebody who says, oh, I had this, whatever treatment, it didn't work. Well, it's like saying I was short of breath, I got a bronchodilator and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. I need to know 16 other things in the next 5 minutes to figure out what should have happened, or maybe should have been a bronchodilator and three other things. Mm-hmm. So probably the best way, a simple metaphor is if you're starting a fire, you can have a match, you won't get much. You can get a stack of wood, you won't need much. If you really want a fire, you need a match and some lighter fluid and a stack of wood. And so in the same way, of all the systems, I think that's why we don't have a poster yet. You know, I'm working on it.
I know, but you've wanted one for some time.
The reason there is no sexual response or orgasm poster is it involves so many different parts. Mm-hmm. Anything could be off and it throws it off, from the psychology to blood flow to hormones. So you have to have endocrine, metabolic, the cardiovascular. Everything has to line up. It's a wonder anybody has sex. So back to our procedure, and then I'll stop and breathe for a minute. But our procedure, the OSHOT procedure that we do, is wonderful for making tissue healthier, just like it works for the shoulder or the thigh muscle of a football player. It makes the tissue healthier, and it's been shown to help with scars and wound care for a decade before we ever used it in gynecology. It's been shown to make tissue healthier, new blood flow, new nerve, neurogenesis, and help torn muscles. And if you have something that can be helped by that, as in pelvic floor pain or nerve damage from childbirth or decreased blood flow, which has been proven to happen just with the aging process in the, mm-hmm. just like it happens in the male, in the clitoris or in the urinary sphincter, all the different layers of muscle there, all those things, if the problem could be helped by making those things healthier, then great, our OSHOT's going to help. If your problem with sex is because your lover's beating you up or you have no hormones, you may need that as well or instead of. So mm-hmm. but there are certain things like lichen sclerosis and you're leaking some because your urinary sphincter is weak and you're not ready to have surgery. There are certain problems like stress incontinence. You can have an orgasm, but it's decreased. Lichen sclerosis, pelvic floor pain. There are certain things that our OSHOT is dramatically helpful for, as you know. Mm-hmm. But it's not a magic shot. But for those things, it can be like magic and work dramatically in the right hands with someone who knows how to do it. as you know, which we provide and certify and license people to do it at the Cellular Medicine Association. And you've trained people yourself, one of our trainers. And so someone who knows what they're doing and mm-hmm. is using it in the right person for the right reason, it can be miraculous.
And so what I'm hearing with all that is, again, 1 to 2 questions in from the gynecologist isn't going to deep dive into the cause. And one solution that fits all is not going to be a solution. Yes. And so, you know, again, it's a matter of opening those conversations somewhere. You know, sometimes they're not talking to friends or family and they don't have a doctor that's talking to them about those issues. So they're looking for places to go and providers to, you know, to offer solutions. And comprehensive solutions, I agree, are 100% the way to go, the answer there. But 1 or 2 questions in and 1 solution that fits all is definitely not going to work with women's health. And so,
yeah. I'll give you an example of how it can go wrong. So there was a very prominent plastic surgeon and a few towns over from me here on the Gulf Coast who treated a woman for painful intercourse or dyspareunia with his new vaginal laser. And she got worse. So then she went to one of our providers who found out that this was a petite little Japanese lady married to King Kong. So she didn't need a tighter vagina. So yeah. she gave her an O-shot to help her with healing and gave her a vaginal dilator. And now she has wonderful circus sex with King Kong. But that was not the place to use a laser. And so part of the reason for, maybe the main reason, one of them, for your great success as a healer in the sexual medicine arena is you don't have a bunch of tools on the shelf and you're just randomly picking. You understand how the systems analysis approach works and are able to think about, let me think about metabolic, psychological, muscular, neurovascular, how's it all working together on a detailed basis, and then choose the right tool for the right person.
Yes, no, I agree. And again, it's interesting to see that, like, even I had just to see the difference between men and women. And again, we treat both, you know, mm-hmm. I just feel like we haven't had as many open conversations with women about sex. And because it's, you can fake just about anything, but you can't fake sex or a pain, right? You know, yes. And so that's the one time. But I had a new, my nurse practitioner that's been with me for a while, but when she came on board, she'd been treating men with hormones. And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden, you know, I have like a tissue box in my room while I'm training her. You know, there were multiple women we saw that day that got mm-hmm. tearful, you know, and you have to pull out the tissue. And, mm-hmm. and finally, when the patient would leave the room after about like probably the fifth one that day, she said, I don't know, like, I'm not used to this, because she had been at one of the testosterone clinics. She said, do all of the women cry after? Mm-hmm. I'm not used to that. And mm-hmm. it just goes to show that they finally had somebody that listened. Yes. And we see it. So we're 5 years out from that. Mm-hmm. And we still see it every day that yes. they finally have somebody that actually listens to them. Yes. And then we looked recently, because we did a podcast on hysterectomies, and just the increase in depression related to early hysterectomies or surgical menopause mm-hmm. was astounding, yes. because you'll have sexual dysfunction that then leads to depressive symptoms, and then they're placed on an antidepressant when in actuality, the root cause is the sexual dysfunction. So they're like a 200% increase in, you know, depression after a hysterectomy. And yet we don't give them those stats prior to surgery.
Yes. You
know, or we would look at things differently, I think.
Yes. You know, one of my favorite little tricks is to, before the woman has a hysterectomy, and as you know, one of the most evil, sneak up on you, horrible diseases is ovarian cancer. And because usually, as you know, by the time you discover it, it's gone too far. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure you're the same way. I'm not anti-surgery, but you have to think about it. And so one of my favorite tricks is, okay, you have a hysterectomy. Let's do your blood work now. And then, because I can do better than your ovaries anyway, they're going to eventually wear out. And then after your hysterectomy, we'll put you back to those same levels. Why anyone would not want to take that approach, I don't know, to put people back to where they were rather than just let them, let their values fall and see how you do. There's one of my favorite researchers who was writing, and she's from Australia. She was writing about testosterone in women, how it attenuates the autoimmune response with lupus. And because, you know, women get more autoimmune diseases, and it's thought partly due to the protective effect of testosterone. Mm-hmm. I think it was her who did a study. I know this was out 20 years ago, where they just gave women testosterone right before the hysterectomy, before they did it, like the day before of it. You get a shot of testosterone. Mm-hmm. And they did tremendously better. They healed faster. They weren't as depressed. I mean, you know it's going to drop. So why would you wait for the woman to come in falling apart? And why not replace it? Assuming that you know how to do it in a safe, intelligent, strategic way, and you're not just slamming everybody with the same dose.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's actually interesting. I hadn't proposed that to any of the women, because we'll have some that if only they allowed maybe a little opposing of the estrogen mm-hmm. with some progesterone, we may not end up with, you know, a surgical need or an ablation. But, you know, doing testing levels pre mm-hmm. and then, you know, matching those, because you're right, we can get them better. But speaking of which, though, the autonomic system. So this is what the Clitoxin is about, because again, I'm going to learn even more. That's the first time that I heard you and your beautiful wife presenting that research down in Miami, you know, what was it, a month ago? Not even quite. Mm-hmm. So I want to hear more about that, the autonomic nervous system and your chart of sexual, you know, function, but also then how clitoxin or a botulinum toxin in the clitoris helps improve.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Just to make sure I'm on schedule. So we have, you're going to end on the hour. Is that right?
Yes. And what time?
So we have 12 minutes. Okay. Yep. So I'll give you the quick version in case you have some of your listeners have questions. Yes. But here's the quick version. It's as we just talked about, if you look at how sexual response is measured by standardized testing in women, it's libido or desire and arousal, lubrication, orgasm, and pain, and then overall satisfaction. Those are the main domains for women when it comes to sex. Every one of those things, except for pain, is the autonomic nervous system, the part we can't control, the part that tells your heart to beat and your bowels to move. And there's a sympathetic that makes you run. It's the fight response. You're running from a tiger, fight or flight. And then there's the parasympathetic, where you know all this, but I'm of course saying this for the benefit of your readers, your listeners. So for the parasympathetic is the relaxed response. It's what that's what the man needs to have an erection, and a woman, although she may get aroused on the back of the Harley Davidson, she may get her heart rate going faster, or on the roller coaster, she becomes sexually aroused after the excitement, and that study's been done. So when she goes parasympathetic, or she goes running and then she stops running and she relaxes, that's when the parasympathetic response is most responsible for arousal. But the problem is most of the thinking has been about the sympathetic. There's one nerve or one main nerve, the dorsal nerve of the clitoris, that has sensation to the brain that says, okay, we're being aroused, we're being touched or whatever. But then, as you know, there's the parasympathetic nervous system where you have the cavernous nerves, which then attach to the inferior hypogastric place and goes to the ganglion in the vaginal wall, which then it goes first to the ganglion, then to the inferior hypogastric plexus, then up to the hypothalamus, where you feel aroused. So it goes. So there's a direct connection between the autonomic nervous system, which is actually larger in number and mass than the somatic nervous system. And the studies actually show, there's been two studies that I saw where they put slings, midurethral slings, in cadavers and looked, and depending on how you do it, there can be dramatic damage to the autonomic nervous system. So that response that causes you to be aroused can be, in some cases, and as the research bears this out, can interfere with the response and maybe with hysterectomy as well. So what I did was took, because we know from the migraine studies that when you inject this, when you're treating migraines, you're not helping the migraine because you're relaxing the muscle. That has been shown. That's what they thought, but it's helping the migraine because we inject here, it goes along the nerve and affects the ganglion, the trigeminal ganglion, the caudate nucleus, and then that tells the brain to not feel pain. So I thought if that worked in the clitoris the way it works in the face, we could basically, just like in the face, you use the procerus muscle as a port to inject the caudate nucleus, the trigeminal ganglion. We could use the clitoris as a port to inject the parasympathetic ganglion and even the sympathetic ganglion to change the tone. And so basically it's like the clitoris as at a already heightened state. And what most women are saying, and of course my wife Alex, same last name by the way, but she's not a cousin, kind of hoping she would be, same last name with two N's. So Alexandra Runnels, she's my wife. So she's treated quite a number of people, and I've treated some people, and it is without scripting them, almost every one of them will say, I'm more easily aroused. I feel like more like it must be to be a man. The same things arouse me, but I'm quicker to be aroused, and I don't have to wonder as much as I used to have to wonder, will I become aroused? So I think this is for the woman who is still not a magic shot, but this is for the woman who, someone like yourself, thinks about them intelligently. And if their problem is they're having pain, well, maybe they need surgery for their big ovarian cyst, or maybe they need a pelvic floor injection with just PRP. But if their problem is arousal or orgasm and everything else is in place, you know, you've thought about their hormones and they still just aren't quite where they want to be, then this can be miraculous. And in those cases, when we injected the clitoris, it worked by far, literally twice as well, judging by FSFI, female sexual function index, worked twice as well as any drug on the market. So I think it's going to be, again, not a magic shot, but for the right person. And we have two decades of history knowing that women can take, these are the same sort of dosages, less than by a third what we use in migraine, and it's less than we use in most women for cosmetic and for bladder spasm. And so we have two decades showing that botulinum toxin in females of childbearing age is safe as long as they're not pregnant at the time you do it. Two decades. It's just never been used to actually enhance sexual response. It's been used to help with, or it's been tried for other things like bladder spasm and vaginismus. So anyway, that's my rant. If you have.
And so and then we'll open it up. But as you said, you know, again, those off-label uses, a lot of the Botox and even fillers for aesthetic are off-label.
Oh, heck yeah. When you use Botox, when you use botulinum toxin, we're mostly using Xeomin, or some use Dysport. But if you're and because I actually have had some people lately that are becoming resistant to the Botox, which is not supposed to happen, as you know, with Xeomin, because it doesn't have that extra protein on it. But anyway, if you are doing most of what we do in the face, you're using it off label. If you're using it for bruxism, as you know, smoker's lines, crow's feet, all that's an off label indication. And just like Wellbutrin is, or testosterone is, all off label for sex. But the good thing is that if so far we've had no bad sequelae. We had a couple of people where their response went down for a week and it came back better than ever. But if you, the good thing about using one of those medicines is that they wear off. So just like with everyone, of course, we have, who knows, we could have something unexpected. So just like with any other treatment. But if it works like it works everywhere else, if you had something you didn't like, it's going to wear off. But when it works, it's lasting 6 months or longer before people want another injection. And if you throw it in with our O-Shot, it even improves it. It's already better than anything else on the market. But when you combine it with the O-Shot, it's even better. It's out the roof.
Have you done anything that's looked at the PRP with that, with the Clitox, or alone yet?
Yeah, so Clotoxin. So as an example, flibanserin, which is on label, as you know, and bromelinotide, which is on label, they both give a response that's around 5 on the total improvement of total female sexual function index. Well, a placebo bumps it by 3.5. So both of those are a little bit more better than placebo when they got approved. Clotoxin alone, C-L-I-T-O-X-I-N for your people who might want to read about it, but Clotoxin alone bumped it by 8, which was twice as much as bromelinotide and almost 50% more than flibanserin. But when we combined it with PRP, it bumped it by 12. So it improved it by 50%. Here's the other number, and then I'll be quiet again because we just got 3 minutes. But if you just survey, if you do FSFI on just women walking in the office and say, my sex is bothering me, it's interfering with my relationship, on the average, they'll have a female sexual function index of 20. And to get to the normal range, you got to get to 26.5. And flibanserin overbumps it by 5. Bromelinotide only by about 4. So neither one of those really get from the average of 20 at start to pass to 26.5, which is what you need to feel normal again. Most women who are not complaining at all come in with this research has been done, they come in with a level of around 30. Well, when you combine botulinum, and neither one of those drugs come close, so people wind up doing more than one thing. When the right person, though, when you do Clitoxin combined with our O shot, it bumped it by 12, which is enough to take that person at 20 past the 30, where now she's up there with her friends that are talking about, you know, their circus sex. She goes from 20 to that. Nothing on the market does that. Nothing. Again, I don't want to couch it as a magic shot, because if you're getting beat up or you got pain or your hormones are out of whack, you're not going to probably get that response. But if everything's in order and then you add this in, you better make sure your husband's not going, or your lover's not going on a long business trip. They need to be home.
Right. We always say no man left behind. When we get the women feeling better, and they will come in tearful because they do not have the sex level of their husband or significant other. And then I'm like, well, be prepared, because when we get you feeling better, we'll need to see him too. And they actually have trouble believing it, but we say no man left behind, you know, because that's
where. Can I give you my 3 categories of women when you start off? Here's my 3 categories. Yeah. First category is the woman who comes in crying about her relationship and her sex, but her husband is just treating her like dirt. And usually when you get her well, she's going to leave him. And there's nothing you can do about it. And he's not going to come see you because she's gone. Maybe nothing you should do about it. But she resents all the years of abuse and she's gone. The other category number 2 is she's got a healthy husband who treats her like a queen in spite of things not being so good in the bedroom. And you get her better, you're done, right? They go live this. They get the next boat to freaking Jamaica and they run naked for the next week. So then the third category is the one you're talking about. That's the one who she loves her husband, but he's not so healthy. And then you get her well, and she comes in crying because he can't keep up. And so then you have to get him in. But those are my 3 categories. And I'll bet you're like me. You can tell which category they're in within 5 seconds of walking into your office. It's the third category. You got to be ready to take care of that husband.
Yes, absolutely. And it's actually interesting because some of the husbands were like, I had no idea I had a problem until a month ago. Until she got better. So that happens too. So we'll wait. I'm going to see if there's any questions in the meantime. What I wanted to say just quickly, because when we were recently at that conference, that was about, you know, cosmetic gynecology. And so they did a lot of talking about labiaplasty. Just real quickly, when they said, you know, it's up a significant, you know, amount, 75% is what I had seen in research prior to that conference. And the one plastic surgeon said 150% in his practice. He thought it was because not enough providers were doing the surgery. Do you have any specific, you know, hypothesis on why? I think it's because, again, women don't know enough about what the vagina should look like, but a lot of those pictures looked, you know, relatively normal. I worked the ER for so long, and so did you. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a lot of different vaginas. They're different in appearance, but I never thought, you know, that they needed to look prettier. You know, we do a laser treatment that kind of does that. But do you think there's a reason why labiaplasties surgical wise are up so much?
Well, the numbers are up. Yeah. I think there's, first of all, I think that's could be a misnomer, although in I won't analyze it too much, but at International Society of Cosmetic Gynecology, as you know, you guys do stuff like you help with pain, you help, and sometimes the labia can be so long that literally it's hanging out of the woman's bikini and it's getting pinched. And so there are functional things as well. As you know, there you can have phimosis where the clitoral hood, your listeners may not know this, but the clitoral hood can be scarred down from something where you can't even pull it back and get to the clitoris. So a lot of it, as you well know, is not just about looking different. Mm-hmm. But if I had a reason why I think and one other point is that, as you know, Michael Goodman and others have repeated this study that even if it is just about the way it looks to the woman, when mm-hmm. you make it to where she likes the look of it better, mm-hmm. then functionally her hypothalamus kicks in and her sex actually gets better. It doesn't just look better in the picture. She actually functions better because she feels better about what she's looking at. So, you know, one of my ponderings is that why is it okay to do things to the face if a woman thinks that she would like this wrinkle to go away, or mm-hmm. she'd like to store volume in the cheek, or she'd like to change the shape of her mouth a little bit so that it matches the way she looked 20 years ago, or mm-hmm. or if it's, you know, not a dangerous modification, but a modification within reason to something that makes her feel younger. Why? Most people would not argue with that idea. Mm-hmm. But many of the people who would not argue with that idea in regard to the face will argue that we should just make everybody happy with whatever their vagina looks like, even if it has the labia majora has gone flat and turned gray and the labia minora are not as pink as they once were. And so she's become self-conscious because she knows what the flower looked like 20 years ago. And it's the same flower. It just needs a little watering with your PRP, or maybe it needs something else done to make her feel like she's more proud to spread her legs. Now, some people hypothesize that women are looking at pornography and trying to make their vaginas match what they're seeing. There could be some of that, but my, this is no study I've done, but my feeling from talking to thousands of women is that it's more about they feel empowered mm-hmm. to do the same sort of restoration to every part of their body now, not just to their face. Yeah, they've always had for 50 years, they've had hair products to make their hair look younger mm-hmm. than it might, whether it's the color. My mom said, a woman needs to try every color there is. Like, it's okay to color your hair. It's okay to do green,
but now, I like so, red, but yeah.
It's okay. Well, but you get to try whatever color you want. If you tell me you want to be blonde tomorrow, who am I to argue with you? And but same thing with your face or your breast. But for some reason, people have trouble taking that same relaxed attitude. It's her body. And mm-hmm. and actually projected onto us as care providers that somehow we're twisting their arm and making them feel unhappy about it. No, they have a freaking mirror. They can look. They can see that their labia. Now, and the same thing with the face. If someone comes in and they've got the lips of a 1920s movie star, which was thinner, and they want me to turn them into a movie star more like the 19, like now, which is usually a thicker mouth, I'm going to tell them no. I said, the 1920s, you know, this matches your face more. And mm-hmm. in the same way, I'm not going to push people to do things to their vagina that don't match their body, but she should be allowed to restore and do mm-hmm. things to match whatever makes her want to spread her legs.
Well, I think that there is a question I'm going to pose from the listeners, but just real quick, and I want to talk about this maybe on one of the webinars, is that, you know, having a young staff, like, it's surprising to me. I've heard from a couple of my younger staff, like in their 20s, they're questioning a couple things about their vaginas. And my issue is that once we took out some before and afters and we talked about the anatomy, mm-hmm. it was a misunderstanding, right? Like, so I think that there's some stuff out there on social media that make women kind of question, because it's the younger population that I think it's going up the most in. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting to see if maybe some of the other providers in the group are seeing some of the same, mm-hmm. you know, or hearing, because I was surprised. Like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't think that these young women were even like remotely, you know, concerned about the look mm-hmm. of their vagina. No one had ever said that. So it's not like they'd been to the gynecologist suggesting, you know, mm-hmm. that they had, you know, too much labia, but it was just normal, like labia minora. And mm-hmm. they didn't know that that was normal, that you could yes. see, and it was visible. So I just am kind of curious, because I've seen and heard, with that rate being up and me hearing that a couple of times, I was just curious to see if others are hearing mm-hmm. the same. Mm-hmm. So, but Fazil is asking, people discuss mental issues, it affects people, why not sexual issues?
That's a rhetorical question. Why not? Yeah. A woman should be empowered to have a conversation with whatever issues there are. It brings up the other huge point, which we talked about, but to reemphasize, sex is not just about pleasure. It's about confidence and creativity. Rainer Maria Rilke, who wrote Letters to a Young Poet, he said that your sex drive is directly proportional to your creativity. And you look at, there was a chapter in that old book, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, called Sex Transmutation, which talks about most prosperous, creative salespeople, inventors, they have a high sex drive and they transmute it. Sigmund Freud talked about, he wrote an essay, how he thought Leonardo da Vinci was transmuting his sexual energy and using it for creativity. I had a woman who came to see me and she put her wife in the nursing home, and she had an O shot. Actually, she was same one of our providers, and we had her on the phone talking with her. I was trying to understand more. And she had put her wife in the nursing home, and she said, yeah, I got an O shot. I make love to myself. And why should men have all the fun? I had personally had a patient who sold big industrial things like bulldozers. And she made a lot of money selling big construction stuff, but didn't want a man, loved living alone. But she said, masturbating and having a good orgasm at night helps me rest. It helps me with my, mm-hmm. you know, keep from feeling depressed. Heck, if you have a car with a cracked window that's not even leaking, it bothers you. When your body is not whole, in other words, it's not just about pleasing a man. We're not doing this so that a woman will want to have a penis inside of her. We're mm-hmm. doing it because women need to be empowered to have pleasure too. Even if it's pleasuring themselves, with another woman, with another man, because there are those who would project that onto us. This is about women being empowered to having every part of their body work and being able to tap into the creativity and the confidence and even the spirituality that mm-hmm. which the priesthood should be about, redirecting. You know, good prayer, I think, demands a good sex drive. You can't pray good if you're freaking foggy headed and half dead.
Yeah.
Except maybe for healing. So you have to, it's involved with all of it. And again, I'm ranting, but yeah, we should be able to talk about it, because it's not about just filming a freaking porn movie or even having pleasure. It's about every part of your life.
Yeah. And I did have a other quick questions if you have a moment. And then, but I will say that there's like a woman on social media talking a lot more about like sexual energy. And so in 2024, we actually started in 2023, just incorporating like kind of what I consider that soft, you know, skill or soft service, not where people are just talking about like sexual energy and like opening the conversation. So we do medical stuff, but then allowing people to actually now explore that there's a lot of creative energy and, mm-hmm. you know, this is where it all originated, right? And so talking about female sexual energy and male sexual energy, and not just, like you said, from a sex intercourse type of way, mm-hmm. but in all the other ways. So I did have Brandy comment about, you know, just a lot of women walking around with insecurities and questions and nowhere to get answers. So mm-hmm. that kind of addresses that young. I do think that exists. And it was something that I just learned over the last few weeks because I hadn't heard that before from young women as concerned as three young women. So what are the chances, you know, that there's three young women having that same conversation and they all had questions. So, and then there's another question about downtime with the clitoxin.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you think about when you have botulinum toxin put in your face, you can go do whatever you want to. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with clitoxin. There's no damage actually with the O-shot as well. I always encourage people to go home and have sex. The yeah. blood flow is good for it. The only downtime would be is if the doctor somehow combined it with a vaginal laser, or maybe some of our physicians, as you know, will tack our procedure, O-shot or clitoxin, at the end of a surgical procedure, or it, and there's a numbing cream involved, so you need to go home and wash that off, or else it gets on places where you may not want to be numb on your lover and on yourself. But usually it's just, unless there's something else involved, you just go home, you sit in the bath, you wash off the numbing cream and go have fun.
Yeah.
Now watch, it takes about 2 days for botulinum toxin to start to work. This is in general and including the clitoxin. It takes about 2 weeks for full effect. With platelet-rich plasma, with our O-shot, as you know, this, you know all this, but for mm-hmm. the benefit of your listeners, for the PRP part of the O-shot, it's a fertilizer, so you have to wait for new tissue to grow, and that really starts at about the 3-week mark with full effect around 8 weeks to 12 weeks mm-hmm. before it reaches full effect, and it's good usually for somewhere between 9 months to a year and a half. We're not sure yet with the clitoxin. Some of the male studies for erectile dysfunction, it lasts 6 months, sometimes 9 months. Mm-hmm. But probably at the doses we're using now, it's going to be about 6 months. And at the our usual dose at 50 units, it'd be like getting a facial treatment. Most people get that much every 3 months for their face. So 50 units every 6 months, it'd be similar as the number of botulinum toxin. The only difference is there's more time involved with your provider figuring out how to modify it, and there's preparation for the platelet-rich plasma, and there's costs mm-hmm. with that. So the cost would be more than for the face, but and it's not going to be outrageous. It's not going to be a $10,000 procedure like a surgical procedure.
But then you also might get sooner effects with the, you know, botulinum toxin in addition to the PRP. So you get all that regenerative and maybe yes. some effects with.
Yeah. yeah. Our study showed a synergy where it was 50% more yeah. effect with the two combined, but then somebody might've had an O-shot last week. And so in that case, you just use the botulinum toxin, but the, otherwise there's really no reason just to have the botulinum toxin unless it might be budget.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you. And that answers. And if anybody has any other questions, you can leave them in the comments and we'll go ahead and answer those. I will close up by saying thank you so much for joining me
today.
Thank
you. I need to make sure your listeners know that I've trained thousands of doctors in 50-something countries, and nobody tops Deborah Durst. She's got the right heart, the right knowledge base, the right volition, and you can't do better. So,
thank you.
You're listening to the right warrior that's out fighting for women's health. So thank you for having me on your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your kind words, and thank you for being on. And I will talk with you on your next webinar with the group. And you have a wonderful evening. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.